Hello everyone and welcome to a very special episode of Yes Sir HR. Actually, welcome to a very special 50th episode of Yes Sir HR. My name is Mark and I'm with...
Yes, it's me, Dennis, and it's a half century.
Yeah, it's a half century. Can you beat that? You know, when we started talking about this, I'll be honest, I didn't think we would get to do 3 episodes, but here we are in the 50th episode. How about that?
Yeah, and we are just at the beginning. This will go on, and we will make it global, mate.
Well, I love your enthusiasm. I believe that you had a good break. You were back in the old Blighty.
Yeah, really good. I was going to go to Bulgaria and Romania, but I thought I'll postpone that and visit my 2 daughters and their partners. And had a wonderful time. Really good. Yeah, so okay. It's been good.
Were things like slowed down or delayed because of the Queen's passing?
Not where we were. The I saw bits of it on TV, but I didn't go down in queue for like, 24 hours. So minimal involvement. Yeah, sad to see her passing. She did it, at the end of the day, whether people agree or disagree with the monarchy, at the end of the day, she's born into that role and she did it, with great poise and benefit to the country. I mean, it does cost a lot of money. We know all that, but the money that probably the royal family generate in terms of people visiting England, etc. Sad, but let's look at it this way. She had a good life, very productive, and that's all I can say.
Yep, it's the end of an era. Okay, so we promised everyone that when we reach the 50th episode, we will spend a bit of this episode looking back at our own teaching careers. And sharing a little bit of anecdotes and stories of how we have made use or how evidence-based creative teaching has actually impacted our own teaching practices and maybe the success of our students. So today's episode is going to be strictly based on Dennis and Mark talking about the good old days and their own stories. So maybe you would you like to add anything to that, or should we just jump straight into it?
No, well, let's look at what we're doing. The philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, Frenchman, spent a lot of time sitting in cafes, smoking Galois cigarettes, and probably drinking coffee, talking about the human condition, and probably one of the most influential existential philosophers of the century. And one thing that Sartre said that I think is really important, and that is that we learn everything in life through stories.
Yeah.
So what we're doing now, if you think about it, every podcast that we make is a story about an aspect of education based on our professional involvement and perspective on it. So what we're doing now is just sharing some stories of experience that connect in some way to teaching practices. And what I think I can say at the outset is that for myself as a teacher, more I've understood how learning works, what makes highly effective, efficient and creative teachers, that has helped me become a better teacher. And this is the point, is our friend Jeff Petty once wrote that great teachers really fundamentally impact people's lives. And I'm going to say one more thing before we kick in with the story. That if you actually think about it, if you're a plastic surgeon and somebody comes along and they want their nose improved or other parts in anatomy, got to be careful how we phrase these things, haven't we? And the plastic surgeon does a super job, picks up his or her $20,000, pounds, whatever it is. And if the person is happy with it, they're delighted, they thank the surgeon, thank you so much. Unfortunately, as a teacher, you never really know the impact you have in the longer term. And I'll start with one story now to illustrate that. I was working in Hong Kong about 15 years ago. I worked there quite a few times. Interesting place, actually. Loved the food and very vibrant place. And I was at the airport in the bar having a sherbet. Might have been called beer. And a guy comes up to me and he says, "You're Dennis Sale." And I'm looking at him and I thought, and suddenly the name hit me. I won't repeat his name. It's not fair to say. But cut a long story short, but still the essence of the story. He said, "You remember me? I was one of your students back in whatever year it was." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I've got you. I know, you know, whatever." And he said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "What's that?" And I thought he was going to say, "Can I buy you a beer?"
Yeah.
Which he did anyway. But he said, "I'd like to thank you because you made a massive difference to my career and life." And I'm like, "What?" You know, I'm in Hong Kong airport in bar. And I said, "Well, how did that work?" Chris, his name was, I won't repeat his name. But he said, "Well, when you taught us, you got across the message that if we make effort, we can be successful, but we must develop the ability to persist, to learn effectively." And I said, "Yeah, okay." And he said, "Well, I took that on board. And when I left, I worked hard. I got qualifications, eventually went to university, set up my own company. And that's why I'm in Hong Kong, because I've got aspects of my company here." And I thought, wow. I'll have two beers. but what the story tells us is that if we are excellent teachers, and we've talked about what that means in terms of the way you plan learning and the way you facilitate humankind, all the things that are part of evidence-based creative teaching, which is the gold standard of teacher expertise, that you do impact people. And unfortunately, there'd be so many other people, if you are a good teacher, and we're talking generically here, that the students maybe 5-10 years later, perhaps talking to friends, family, even their own children, say, "Oh, when I was at school, we had this teacher, yeah, Mark Niven Singh, really put a good shift in, felt I learned, believed I could be successful, and even that person made a difference to my progress." But you'll never hear it. And the sad thing, and just to put a corollary on this, is that when you're working as a teacher, all that good work may be invisible to other teachers, to the management. As a friend of mine, I won't name him for obvious reasons, once said that teaching is the second most private act. And I have a story which I may have recalled before, but working in the school, I was pulled in by the deputy headmaster. This is another story. And these stories are connected, and they form a picture of reality of teaching, the world of teaching, the experience of teaching. And it's all about student learning, but sometimes it isn't. And this deputy had pulled me in and said to me, "Dennis, you can tell a good teacher by the way they fill in a register." You've heard this story, but I think it's worth reifying it, because sometimes you have to make the same point a couple of times.
Sure.
And he said, "You can tell a good teacher by the way they fill the register in." And I'm like, "What?" And he then pushes my register to me. He said, "I'll look at your register." And I look at it. And it was in the days when you used to put circles for absent and a line for present, right? And I looked at mine. I thought, "Yeah, I can see circles." And I said, "What's up?" And he said, "Well, look at it. You haven't connected the lines to the corners, and the circles don't touch all four sides." I thought it's a joke. He said, "It ain't funny." I'm like, "What?" And he said, "Now look at Miss So-and-so's." I won't name that person. "And look at her register." And I looked at it, and it was lovely filled in. It was nice and pretty. But yes. And so I said to him, "Can I say something to you?" I said, "Look, do you know what this person does at lunchtime? And do you know what I do at lunchtime?" And he said, "No, well, that's not relevant." I said, "Hold on a minute. It's relevant to me." And I said, "Well, at lunchtime, this person tends to sit in the staff room, spend half an hour filling a register in, and the rest of the time she chit-chats. Okay, no issue with that, right? So what am I doing lunchtime?" "Well, if you ask the PE, head of PE, I won't name the person. And what I do, Monday, I'm coaching the football team. Tuesday, I'm coaching the tennis team. And about 3 or 4 days, I'm in the lunchtime. And we don't get paid for this, let me add. And I said to him, I said, well, what do you think is more educationally relevant? Spending half an hour filling the register in to make it look pretty, or developing students' sporting capabilities, building rapport? And as we know that with sport and that, great and working in that more informal setting, you can build better rapport. And we know from an evidence-based perspective that building rapport is really good. I mean, Anthony Robbins, who earns more than me and you even combined, he once said that rapport is the ultimate tool for getting results with other people. So I said to this person, well, I think what I do is more educationally relevant. And he said to me, just fill the register in properly. And that was it. Now, you know, you put these two stories together, you know, the story in Hong Kong where, you know, you've gone in, you've thought about your teaching, you know, it's important to get rapport. It's important to get students to understand what they're learning, clear goals, all the things that we know now from an evidence-based creative perspective. We were good teachers were doing those things and they learned them through trial and error. All we've done with our approach, evidence-based creative teaching, is take all the research on learning, effective teaching, human conduct, and put it together into a framework that, as a language, you know, we talk about activating prior learning. We talk about kind of promoting thinking to build understanding. We talk about using memory and, you know, those systems to help people retain information, recall it, transfer it, build understanding, all those kind of things, right? Those two stories capture it, don't they? There was a student who had benefited from being in that classroom at that time. If I would never have met him at the airport, I would never have known that. He felt that I was a positive impact as a teacher. How many other students are like that for millions of good teachers globally? Equally, how many, and you might have a story on this, what damage do those teachers who are incompetent, not caring, in other words, teachers who perhaps shouldn't be teaching, what is the similar negative impact on students? Students have gone away and said, oh, I can't do maths, I can't do history, I can't do geography because of the poor teaching that they experience. And that's the reality, isn't it? So that kicks us in, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I just wanted to add to that, when you talk about stories, and that is, I want to share a quote that I just came across from Anthony Robbins, and he says, stories emotionalize information. They give color and depth to otherwise bland material, and they allow people to connect with the message in a deeper, more meaningful way. So let's maybe kick off this with talking about, I know we have talked about this, you have shared your creative teaching model, the acronym SHAPE, where S stands for stories, H yeah. is humor, A stands for activities, P presentation styles, and E the good use of examples. How about that? I still remember that after so many years.
Oh, right. Well, it's nicely widening your long-term memory. And given that we kind of conducted numerous workshops on that, it should be there, because otherwise then you're suffering from dementia. But the good thing is, if you are, you'll probably stop supporting Manchester United. So every cloud has a silver lining, mate, doesn't it? So yep. Be informal, because we are committed, aren't we, to looking at teaching from a very serious, practical, evidence-based point of view. But we try to use a little bit of English and Singaporean humour. So there you go, mate.
Yeah. So I thought it would be nice if we can talk about how we have used stories. And I know you did give the context a little bit, but maybe specifically to how you have managed to use stories to turn students around, you know, getting them to think about the way their motivations or the way that they are learning, and how it has managed to make an impact on them. So, do you want to go first?
Yeah, well, this was one in Singapore, right? And it was really interesting. If you remember the days when me and you used to teach on the Learning to Learn GEM, yep. that was yep. General Elective Module Program. That is where students had to do additional things to their subject curriculum. So they might be doing business studies, engineering, chemical, mechanical, but they had to do these electives. And it could be anything from like playing the guitar, I think, to learning how to learn. So we offered that Learning to Learn module. You remember teaching on that?
Yep, definitely. I enjoyed myself teaching that module.
Yeah, it was really good. And what we found is that this is my experience and this is the story. And it's a powerful one. And I've used it in many contexts, right? But I remember going into a class, I think it was like Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. So, and the students are doing this GEMS module. They would probably not prefer to do a GEMS module, but maybe joined our class simply because their friends were there, they thought it was easy, or because we're some good looking people, whatever it was, it doesn't matter, does it? And there'd be about 30 of them in there, and I come in the classroom, and I remember one class, I started saying a few things, and I could see a lot of them just didn't look interested. They had that look about them. And Singaporean students don't throw things around or vandalize your car, but if they don't want to be there, they just have that hang dog look of, why are we here? Oh man, that sort of thing. So so I thought, right, let's just stop now. Rather than me start showing slides and talking and wasting my time, let's try to do something. And something comes to my head. As you know, I worked a fair bit in India and quite a bit in Kolkata, right? It used to be called Calcutta. Okay, really enjoyed my time working there. Love Indian food, love the culture, brilliant, right? Okay, but something happened to me one day. I used to get up very early in the morning and have a little walk up Park Street, right? It's kind of equivalent to kind of the main street in Singapore, Orchard Road. And I'm walking down there, and a kid about 13, 14, a male person, come up to me and said, "Can I speak to you?" Now, again, I'm thinking, oh, this kid's going to ask me for money. I just had that, naive assumption. And I looked at him, I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You look like a businessman," because I, as you know, I always dress, even at the Polytechnic, I used to wear a tie and cufflinks and things like that. Remember?
Yeah, yeah.
You do. I'm glad you said that. So I was smartly dressed, and this, this young man thought maybe I'm a businessman. I said, "No." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I'm a street kid. I don't want to be involved in begging and crime, and I want to get a job. I want to learn some skills. I want to get out of this." And this is about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, "Yeah, okay." So he's talking to me, and I said, "Well, what sort of job are you looking for?" He said, "Anything. Don't mind working any hours, He wasn't quoting the union book, the silver book, and we mustn't work after 5 p.m. He just wanted to get a job, to learn some skills, to earn a bit of money, to better himself. Yep. And I'm sitting I'm standing there, I'm thinking, I wish I had a business. I wish I could have said to this kid, "Look, I will get you something in my company." And because I know I wouldn't have to say to this kid, "Can you be here at 9? And would you mind working after 5 o'clock? We're busy." This kid would have worked 16 hours a day, and would have, provided he was treated well and given opportunities to learn. And I said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm not." And I offered to give him some money, probably about $5, and he wouldn't take it. He said, "No, I'm not going to do this." And he said, "Thanks for talking to me." And he walked away. And I didn't think too much about this. Anyway, I'm in now the classroom, 2 o'clock, with this group of GEM students who are looking kind of, "Oh, why are we ill, all right?"
Yeah.
And I thought, right, I'm going to tell them this Kolkata story. And I told them the story. And as I walked around, I'm telling them this story. And now I said to them, and I looked at them, all of them, again, using evidence-based techniques, eye contact, express it to us. I want you now in pairs to talk to each other and say, "What's different between you and that kid in the streets of Kolkata?" Like that.
Yeah.
I said, "Just talk to each other." And they went a bit silent and they talked to each other. Anyway, when I went round, they said, and I also said to them, "I think you guys are really lucky being Singaporean, right?" And so think about that as well. Anyway, to summarize it, first of all, they said, "What's so lucky about being Singaporean?" And I said, "Well, look, for a start, you're young and you're healthy." I said, "That's a pretty good start, and you're Singaporean." And they said, "Well, what's good about being Singaporean?" I said, "Well, go back. Let's now look at the difference between you, your situation, and that kid." And they said, "Well, this kid's got no, opportunity. He's got no money. He's got no education. Here in Singapore, we're pretty affluent, and we've got opportunities to learn and develop." And I said, "Well, now then, listen to me when I tell you that you're lucky, and think about what you can make of this opportunity. That kid didn't have it. You've got it. So I think you should think about how you learn and be appreciative. And they all sat up. And I started the lesson, and they got into it, and, you know, we got them started, you know, as we do. Anyway, I forget about that. The following week when I go in, I walk in, they're all sitting there, and they're all sitting up, and they're all fine. Playing. And they said, one of them said to me, "Hey, Jeff," you know, that thing is, "Yes, sir." "Hey, Jeff," they said, "Hey, Jeff, you do not need to tell us the Kolkata story again. We get it." And they all, like, laughed, you know, they're like, it was, and I said, "Nice. So let's now pick up. What did we do last week? Activating knowledge. Right, we're going to set a learning goal that we want to do, you know, that could be work-related, could be fun, but we're going to commit to it. And we're going to look at the learning process. And we introduce the core principles from a student's perspective." And the group were great. They all progressed. And at the end of it, you know, they really got a lot out of it. So just that power of a story that connected them, for them to say, "Hey, I'm Singaporean. I'm actually really lucky. I'm lucky I'm here in an educational institution, in the best educational system in the world, and I'm getting all this opportunity, and I'm sitting here wasting it." That message got across. So that's the power of the emotion of stories. That story got the students to reframe from thinking, "Oh, we're on the Thursday, have to do this," to say, "Hey, we're really lucky. You know, we should appreciate that and show some damn responsibility." And that's what they did, and that's what I liked.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So for my own story about using stories, and this one was something that was narrated to me, not so much me using it, but I thought it was quite powerful. So he's a mutual friend of ours, Adrian. I'm sure you know him. So he was so one day he was narrating this to me and said, he was trying to teach a very complex topic, and it wasn't anything with regards to I think it was an English lesson, and I'm not sure what exactly the concept was, but here's what he did. He actually played a song that was sort of like a narrative, and I'm pretty sure you know the song. It's "Love Me" by Colin Ray.
Yeah,
you remember the song?
I can't sing it though, mate.
yeah, but you do know the song, right?
It's
about this boy who's really singing about how his grandmother has passed on and how his grandfather is suffering from the loss. So he said that, and this is really a testament to the power of stories and songs. So he was saying that as he was playing this, he noticed that one of the students was actually tearing up. Okay, now this is quite amazing. Considering the fact that this song is really about our time, not really something that I would think the students of today would be listening to, but it managed to capture an emotion. So after the song was played, he noticed this, and he just walked forward and asked the student, "Why was this song so emotionally charged for you? Would you like to share your story?" And then she shared that, you know, it really brought back memories of how she misses her own grandmother who passed away, unfortunately, because of a long illness. And said that song really brought back, you know, opened up, you know, good positive memories, of course, but also at the same time reminding her about her loss. So that is where, okay, so now from an evidence-based perspective, so what did he do? So this is where you take advantage of the situation. I think it's called a teachable moment. So use that from the basis, connect that emotion to what was said actually in the song or in the story. How did the composer or how did the author manage to capture that emotion? What was the thinking behind it? And then managing to capture the attention of the class for longer than any other time that you would be able to do it on a Monday afternoon after lunch. So I think that is really talking about the testament or the power of good stories.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that's interesting. Daniel Willingham, who we have mentioned, one of the leading cognitive psychologists in the world, he actually referred to stories as psychologically privileged. And what he means by that is that our brains are wired to really take in stories. And you referred earlier to the emotional impact.
Yep.
Stories have such a powerful impact that we will remember a story, and it will stay with us. I'm going to tell you another story. It happened to me, and I've used it with students. When I was 19, I was in America on holiday, and I was staying with aunts and uncles. I mean, my family, my dad was from East London. That's why I can speak with Cockney accent, mate. You know what I mean, son? And I've also learned the Queen's English as well, so I can do the posh bit, as you know. I'm in America, right? And on my mother's side, they're all Italian, right? And there's a lot of them. And the last day I was there, I met one of my uncles I never met before. I won't name him, it's not fair to refer to his name, but I'd met him before, and he come down to see me, traveled from another sort of part of the state. I looked at this guy, and he made Robert De Niro look soft. Al Pacino would have made him look like Bambi. He had a mohair suit, a fedora, and this guy looked really stunning, a really unbelievably good-looking guy, but with real kind of toughness sort of thing. And he got talking to me, and he said, "Oh, I'll come down and see you, you know, like this, you know, we're Italian American, oh, I'll come down and see my nephew, like, you know, how are you?" And I said, "Okay." He said, "When you're going back to England?" I said, "Well, tomorrow." He said, "Oh, why are you going back?" I said, "I've got to go back to, like, you going to university." He said, "Well, when do you start?" I said, "Well, not for another 2 or 3 weeks." He said, "Why are you going back tomorrow?" I said, "Because I've got this ticket, you know, it's a cheap ticket." Well, it's a cheap ticket. It was a ticket that you had to go back on the day. He said, "Show me the ticket." You know what he did? He tore it up. And he said, "No, I'll buy you another ticket, go back. But you've got to spend a couple of weeks with me, and we're going to, you know, play golf and get to know each other, right?" So I said, "Okay, I'll buy into that." Anyway, I'm playing golf with him, right? And we played a couple of rounds, and I was 19 then. I said, "Oh, Angela, I'm really tired." And he laced into me. I mean, the swear words were in Neapolitan, and he called me everything. You know, the word lazy was very prevalent in the message. And how can you say you're tired at 19 playing two rounds of golf? And he told me how at the age of 12, he was living on the streets of New York, and how he worked and whatever he did. And he was now a millionaire. I mean, there was a rumor that he might have been in the Cosa Nostra, but I don't know. But I mean, he said, "Don't tell me, you'll never say that to me again, that you're tired for that." And I felt so, and I was shocked initially, but I really, and he said, "Right, I've told you now, that's over, let's go and have a beer and forget about it," right? But I remember that story. And when I've kind of worked in classrooms, even though, you know, we teach from an evidence-based point of view, one important thing for students to learn is you've got to show resilience. You know, this business of, "Oh, don't worry, you don't need to do much, you're special," all this kind of stuff. You know, that's dangerous nonsense. That at the end of the day, no matter how much general intelligence you have, if you take a Spearman model or whatever, or even specific intelligence. If you read Nadal's autobiography, did he put a shift in? Did Uncle Tony really push him? So I learned myself that, look, hold on a minute, kind of, you have to make massive effort, you know, Anthony Robbins term. And what I say, I sometimes tell students that story, and I say, "Look, don't tell me you're working hard now, because I know you're not, and you know you're not. Be honest with yourself. Do you really want to do well? And if you do, there ain't no shortcut. You're going to get stuff from outside of your head into your long-term memory system." And that's the importance of evidence-based creative teaching, because we're teaching students the learning process. And the learning process is you can't just get knowledge and just stick it in your long-term memory. You've got to memorize it, think about it. It's the same ongoing process. Memory and thinking are part of the same process. And you've got to engage with it. You've got to connect it to the knowledge that you have. You've got to deal with knowledge gaps, deal with misconceptions, do a lot of retrieval practice. And if it's a skill, a lot of deliberate practice with ongoing good feedback, all of those evidence-based principles. So then you're in a great position with the students to say, look, I've told you this story. You can relate to that story. So now you know you want to be good. You want to be successful. You want to get good grades. You want to get good jobs. You want to be good at X, Y, and Z. You have to go through that learning process. And it does involve putting in a decent shift. So don't whinge about that you can't do it. You can do it because I'm teaching you how to learn. But if you don't put any effort in, at the end of the day, only you can do the learning. So that was a powerful story to me. It really made me think. I never whinged anymore. I thought to myself, look, I've got to put a shift in. And by using that story with students, they understand it. It's still their choice. There's going to be some students who say, oh, I don't care, I'm not going to bother. Well, fine. But don't whinge when you fail the module. Don't come to me and give me, oh, it's unfair, I've been discriminated against. No, you haven't. You have discriminated against your own ability to put a shift in. So blame yourself. And I did have, funny enough, when you know the GEMS module, going back to that, I had a couple of students one year who, nice enough lads they were, but they'd come in late and they'd look sheepish and they'd apologise. But they didn't disrupt the class, I wouldn't have that, but they didn't do the work. And I reminded them, I said, guys, look, you fail for two reasons here. One is you don't meet the attendance rule, right, which we had 70%, whatever it was, and you don't do the work. So if you fail, it ain't me. You're choosing to fail. Fine, that's your call. I will help you, but I'm not going to come live with you and, you know, ring your parents up and start threatening me. It ain't going to work because that's no good for you. Anyway, cut a long story short, they did fail. And what they did was interesting was they apologised to him. They said, Chair, oh, we must have been really stressful. I said, no, you're not unpaid to do this job, to help you learn. It ain't just about the school subjects. It's about you developing as a person and being able to, you know, be a productive in the workforce, but also a decent citizen. All the values, everything that we, you know, that we're on. And they said, well, can we retake the module? I said, well, you can, but if you do the same thing, you're going to get the same results, aren't you? And they're like, yeah, I get that. So I said, are you going to do the work? If you're not going to do the work, there's no point, right? Yeah, all right. Okay. Anyway, cut a long story short, they joined the next, you know, we used to run that cyclically, didn't we? Anyway, they joined and, you know, they didn't put massive effort in, but they did do the assignments. They did pass. And at the end of it, they thanked me. And I said, look, lads, hope you've learned something here. This is a learning process. When you go to work, if you do what you did at the beginning, you're late, you don't do the work, you're not going to be dealing with me. You're dealing with an employer and say, look, you're no good, you're not doing the job, go away, go somewhere else. That's the real world of work. And they're like, yeah, we've learned something. I said, well, then it's been worthwhile, isn't it? So,
yep.
You know, that's a real story, isn't it? You know what I mean? About, you know, the impact of things. And when you tell kids stories and you use these examples, it makes them think about, well, you know, I've got to have some agency, I've got to take some responsibility. And we want students, one of the big things about our approach, we want students to become self-directed. So we've got to help them to understand the learning process. And these stories are often the things that help them to, you know, to see the importance of persistence, resilience, and doing the deliberate practice, doing the retrieval practice, which is often boring. But that's, you don't get good at anything just by not making a big effort and experiencing some mental and physical strain sometimes. It goes with the territory.
Yeah. So I think we have established that, you know, stories are quintessential and essential part of any good teachers' arsenal. But I think more than that, they also have this knock-on effect of one of the other core principles of learning that we have talked about. And that is really, I think stories help to, as you rightly pointed out, create rapport. But more importantly, also they help to create a positive climate that is success-oriented and fun. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. If you think about it, those stories have an emotional impact because they capture reality and it connects to the student's experience. And the very fact that you share something that's personal to you, like me telling students about, you know, my uncle, you know, making me feel a bit a bit bad, they can connect with that. So it builds rapport. But then what you're always saying is that, well, you don't have to fail. And that's the point. And you can not end up getting yourself in a mess if you manage yourself better. And managing yourself better is, one, learning what you need to know to achieve your learning goal. So if you need to get your diploma or your degree or your A-levels, you have got to put a shift in. And also to recognise that there will be times when you don't feel like doing it. Because in IT, you know, we teach in part of our program is that willpower is limited, that you're not going to always feel like putting a massive shift in. And it's important to do interleaving that we talked about before. Well, put a good shift in, then go and play a game of football, go out with your mates, do something that's really intrinsically rewarding that's not to do with, but then come back to your work. Don't just leave it. So, you know, get that balance of self-regulation, because it's those self-regulation skills, the metacognition, knowing that you need to plan your stuff, you need to manage it, you need to monitor how you're doing, you need to evaluate it, and you need to sometimes modify the strategy. But you can still have fun in that process. And that's where we talk about a learning environment that's success orientated and fun. You can make it so that the students meet the attainment, their learning goals, but enjoy the process. It's like doing a horrible job. I once worked as a labourer on a building site, right? And I'm pumping cement around and scaffold poles and things like that. But I worked with the foreman, the ganger, the person in charge, with a really good bloke. He was an ex-army boxer. And he would, like, when we come in the morning, lads, we've got to put a bit of shift in. Let's do this. And we go and have a cup of coffee and kind of, you know, we had a bit, we'd tell each other jokes. He was in charge, but he wasn't there, you know, treating us like we were kind of slaves, but going, look, lads, we've got to get the scaffolding up, or we've got to get the scaffolding down, so let's put a good shift in for an hour, and then we're, you know, at that time I used to smoke roll-up tobacco, like, let's sit down, we'll have to roll up and a smoke for 15 minutes and tell a few stories, you know, like humour stories. So the kind of, that's such an important thing. You don't, a good teacher can make learning both effective, and if the students are learning, they're experiencing success, and nothing breeds success like success. But you can also make that psychological climate one that's fun. So even if we're doing a boring task, well, let's learn the factual content in a quiz situation. Let's have a little break and kind of do a bit of downtime and have a bit of a laugh, get someone to tell a funny story or something. It's not about more is not better, better is better. So to teach qualitatively better in the long run means that you're much more effective than teachers are going in and getting the kids to sit there and look at hundreds of PowerPoint slides and be bored stiff. So that's the big message, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm glad you shared that because when I was talking about, you know, building that success, a positive climate that's success oriented and fun, I remember when I first started teaching. And I mean, when you were training to be a teacher, I don't know whether this was your experience, but it was always very technical. Oh, this is how you write a lesson plan. This is how you do this. This is how you do your pedagogical practices. But there was never a lesson that really taught you how to build rapport and how to create a positive climate that is psychologically safe and fun. So, I don't know if I shared this story with you before. I'm pretty sure I did in one of our long talks, but I just want to share it again. When I first started teaching, they gave me, for want of a better word, a challenging class. And the reason for that is because, looking at your size, you'll be able to handle them. And mind you, I was just a brand new teacher. So going into the class thinking, you know, this is whatever I've learned, you know, I'm going to apply it. It all went away in 5 minutes because they looked at you. They were like, okay, so what are you going to teach us that we don't already know? I mean, like, who the hell are you? You know, like, what makes you think that you are going to be any better than the last teacher we had who we managed to chase away and cry and make the student and make her cry and so forth. So I thought it was a bit of a cognitive dissonance for myself. And to be honest, the first day, I also thought that it might have been my last day of teaching, because one student actually decided that he would walk out in the middle of my class. And just so happened that the class is next to the toilet. So he didn't ask for permission. He just walked off, went to the toilet. And of course, everybody is now looking at me and thinking like, okay, so what are you going to do? If I don't do anything, they will obviously think, okay, then obviously I can do whatever I want because the teacher doesn't care. And if I do something, now what am I going to do? Because you can't exactly take a student by the collar and then punch the student senseless and then not expect to keep your job. So what did I decide to do? Being young, stupid, and really honestly, wet behind the ears, literally, I actually took his desk, carried his desk and his chair, walked to the toilet, dumped the table and the chair in the toilet, and told him to do his studies there and don't come back into my classroom. Now, looking back at this in my career 22 years ago, it sounds funny now, but it certainly wasn't funny. Funny then.
You never told me this story before, but yeah, okay, yeah. We could make an old series of jokes on this, but continue.
Yeah, so when that happened, he was quite stunned, and I think he peed himself all over the place because he didn't expect me to bring the table and the chair into the toilet. Now, after I did that and I walked back to the class, I think there was a harsh silence, and even so quiet that the teacher next door actually came over to check whether something happened or somebody died, because the class has never been so quiet before. The other teacher came and looked at me like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I was like, why is everybody so quiet? I said, no, I handled it. And of course, that's what I meant by handled it. Now, here's the funny thing. Because of that, immediate respect was gained, because I stood up, but I did not physically harm the student. And he actually came to apologize. And from then onwards, it was like an automatic, you know, rapport building, settled, done. And because they knew and they trusted me, and they knew that I wasn't going to be going off to complain about them, you know, to either the principal, who would then come and give them another lecture. They decided that, okay, I could be trusted. And that's when I managed to create that kind of climate that is psychologically safe, because they know they can trust me. So even if they weren't happy with certain things, they can talk to me and let me know. And I think we did talk about that, you know, in the previous episode when John Marshall Reese talked about autonomy supporting staff, where we have to acknowledge that not all the time students are going to be eager to learn. Sometimes they do come to class not having or not feeling it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. You've got to be able to accept that from their position, their experience of learning of certain previous teachers, that they don't feel that there's any value, meaning, intrinsic motivation in participating. So you've got to somehow get a reframe. So by you doing that, they might have said, well, generally we don't like some teachers, but this guy's got a little bit of style. Instead of him ranting and giving us a lecture and, you know, punishing the kid, he's just done something that kind of was a bit different and a bit amusing, and it creates what is called in psychological terms a pattern interrupt. All of a sudden they're like, oh, this guy's interesting, maybe we can learn something from him, and he seems a little bit chill, a bit different. So just that Von Rostoff effect of you being seen as a bit different gets them to give attention, which means, you know, it's like it's the film, isn't it? Was it with Michelle Pfeiffer?
Dangerous Minds.
As the one where they wind her up and she leaves the classroom, and the guy says, you've got to get their attention. Because once you've got their attention, then you've got a possibility of affecting them. So once they go into that silent mode of, hold on, this guy's interesting, what's he about? You can then start to sell what you're doing with them. So if we then come in from an evidence-based point of view and say, look, I'm teaching you English, but we're not going to be doing the plot in Romeo and Juliet or something that they have no interest in. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to help you to communicate better with other people so you can make more friends. So, you know, if it's guys, you chat up the girls or whatever, you know, you can put in a good reason to participate. I've told the story before that when I was teaching kind of carpenters too in an FE college, I walked in the classroom and, you know, they're swearing at me, you know, all teachers, you're all, the, you know, they're rough boys. And I just sat there. I thought, there is no, what do I do with these guys? I could either try to argue with them, try to say, oh, it's important to learn communication skills. I just sat down and I just said, I just sat there and said, guys, look, I'm getting paid to sit here with you. You have to sit here for your attendance. So if you just want to keep doing that, it's fine. I ain't going to wipe me up, you know, at the end of the day, but it's a waste of time. And in the end, they just got bored. And I said, okay, then, so what would you like to learn? And, you know, they said, we'd like to be able to talk to girls, you know, chat up girls. I said, well, okay, I'll teach you that. And did. And they, from there on, they, you know, they loved me. In fact, they actually chose to pay to do the City and Girls Communication Skills exams. And they passed those, and most of them got merits and distinctions for over a two-year period. And then I had them again when they were Carpenters 4. And I even chose to have that class, and they loved me for that because they said nobody's ever chose to want to teach us. Anyway, in the last year, I said, guys, look, there's no more exams. You've done your City and Guilds. What would you like to do for the year? So I was letting them define the curriculum. So if they said, well, can we watch videos on the Second World War and talk about it? Well, fine. You know, anything that doesn't contravene what you can do in school, right? And when it's an FE college. So it was pretty flexible. And they said, well, could you teach us O-level English? And I'm like, what? I said, well, yeah, I can. But let me tell you something. We only have an hour a week with together. You're going to have to do something you might not like. It's called homework. And I expect them to say, oh, we're not having none of that night. You know, so, which I said, well, you know, I can't do it. And they said, we'll put shift in. And I did teach them O-level English, and 50% of them passed. And the principal actually come up to me and he said, I can't believe that you got those results with those kids. And I said, well, I've had them for 4 years. I've got good rapport with them, and I've taught them how to learn, and I've taught them how to, you know, communicate well, how to read, how to write, and how to speak. No fancy stuff. I didn't teach them poetry. Nothing wrong with poetry. But what I'm saying is, if you've got kids who are not going to relate to any of that stuff at this point in their lives, they might later on say, oh, that's an interesting area. But I got them to be able to read. I got them to be able to write well and speak well. And, you know, that's how I got them to that stage. And, he did promote me to senior lecturer, and not necessarily on that basis. But so at least I've got a bit of cred with the management as well.
Yep. So I think that's why that's important, building a psychological climate that is safe. And I really believe if you don't do that, I think no matter how much of a good teacher you are, and if they are not ready to learn, I think that's when it just all goes haywire. So we do have time for our last story.
I mean, what I'm going to do is to, you know, tell you a story about something that Daniel Willingham, who I mentioned before, discovered, because you've just said that if you don't get a good psychological climate, you might be very well organised and do a lot of preparation, but it don't work. What Daniel Willingham did is, and, you know, this is a story that really, in a sense, summarises something that's important. And what he said is, he looked at the way teachers were evaluated in different institutions, and he said that on average there were about 32 items that they asked students about their teachers. And he said, essentially, all of these 32 items boil down to two constructs. One is the teacher well organized? And the second one, is the teacher a nice person? Now, if you take those two constructs, what you were saying about the psychological climate, that's very much about the teacher being a nice person. And that has a number of things. Is this teacher fair with us? Does this teacher show equity in terms of the way he or she relates to us? Are we being asked to do things that are reasonable and can be justified? Those kind of things. Is this teacher someone who makes eye contact with us, can smile? All of these very subtle things. We know that just the use of a smile has a massive subconscious impact, impacts mirror neurons and things like that. So if you smile at students, they can't help but smile back eventually. So if you speak with an expressive voice, you make good eye contact. And there's a skill in doing all of these things. It's not like the McDonald's person say, oh, have a good day, sir. But they look at you as though, you know, you're just, you know, looking through you. So all of these interpersonal skills, which is all part of evidence-based creative teaching, is partly about coming across as a nice human being. However, if you can't teach the subject, which is the teacher well organized, they might say, oh, Mark Niven's saying, lovely bloke, real good, you have a laugh with him, really like his lesson, haven't learned any geography, you know, apart from the fact that, you know, we live on the planet sort of thing. So the technical aspects of teaching, that, you know, the evidence-based core principles of activating prior knowledge, you know, chunking the lesson up, getting students to think, even though it's a bit tiring, but to build understanding, putting variety into the lesson, all of those kind of things, feedback. Yeah, that's key. So the teacher that's well organized in terms of those things and as good cred as a human being, you know, which is core, you know, which relates to the core principle of psychological climate and success, you know, success oriented and fun. You put those two together and that really is your perfect blend. So that's the story to tell teachers, because if they can do those two things well, you know, and it's anchored in an evidence-based approach, that's really good. That's what it's about, isn't it? Yep. So stories help the learning process cognitively and particularly effectively, but they're great for building rapport as well. And so, you know, that's my summary frame. And I could tell dozens of other stories. I'll tell one more, we've got a little bit of time. And that was just to illustrate something. I worked in Fiji for a couple of weeks, and on one day we had computers. The guys there, these are Pacific Islanders from different islands, Solomon Islands, Cook Islands, Tuvalu, whatever, and massive guys. And I remember there was a guy called Joe. He was about 6'4" tall and about 6'8" wide. He was a massive guy. Anyway, we got the computer set up. These guys have never used a computer in their life, right? And they're looking at me and I'm saying, look, by lunchtime, you will be able to produce. And I just showed him a PowerPoint slide with a picture in it and some text. And this is what you're going to do by 12 o'clock. And they're looking at me in absolute disbelief. But by using, you know, an evidence-based approach, I went through it. Key concepts. This is a mouse. You know, it's not one that runs around in the house that your cat chases. I mean, it was like that. And this is how it worked, left click, right click. Anyway, and there's the screen, and you can see this. Can you see that orange thing there? You can move the mouse, and I've got them to do it, and double click on it, and this opens up. And then to show them how to put a bit of text in, how to save it. And then I said, where do you think it goes? Don't know. Right, so I showed them how to find it. So I said, now, double click and open it up. I want you to close it. So yeah, they closed it. I said, now open it. I've got them to do it 5 times. Deliberate practice, retrieval practice. And I said, now I put the text in. Now I'm going to change the text. I went to the menu, size, color, and just did that. I said, you do that. And they're looking at it. And then they did it. And I said, do you want to move it around? You know, so I showed them how to, and I said, well, we're going to put a picture in. How'd you do that? Just go to that menu, see where it says picture, click on that. And that goes into, and then you just click on that and it goes in. And I said, you can move it around. You can resize it. And by 12 o'clock, they could all do that comfortably and other things. They put video in. Anyway, that night, me and my colleague, we went to the bar and had a couple of beers. And we're wondering where these were all guys. They were all maritime people. And we thought, where are the boys? We went there. They're still on that PowerPoint thing, learning new things. It motivated them so much. And the big point of the story is that if you teach well, you can teach very relevant, useful things by way of, I think Jerome Bruner used the term, anything can be taught to anyone by way of courteous translation. So if you teach well and you have that kind of personality to build rapport, you can get kids who can start off, oh, I can't do it, Chair. Oh, too difficult. Oh, no, no way to do that. And then by them achieving success, that really shows, you know, so many key aspects of the learning process. Take the information, manageable chunks, key concepts, get it in your head, pull it out back into working memory, do it again, that cements it in long-term memory, then you keep building on it. And that's what makes you learn. And if you keep learning, you get better at it. If you get better at it, you do better in attainment tests. That develops self-efficacy. And if you keep persevering and you believe that with effort and good teaching and you put in effort, you can achieve more and more. That's the process to becoming an effective self-directed learner, isn't it?
Perfect. Okay. So that's it. So that's episode 50 done and dusted. We hope you enjoyed the walk with us back in time a little bit. It was a fun episode to do. We'll move back to regular scheduled programming next week onwards. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so by writing to us at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, it is evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. So, before we end off, what's the plan for the week, Dennis?
Well, having just come back from holiday, I've got a few things to sort out. I'm working with a school here, and the new term has started, and I'm working with folk there to see how I can be useful.
Right. Okay. So it looks like you have stuff to do. We will be busy as well. So take care, and we'll speak to everyone soon. So goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me.